I'm Steve Giacoletto, and I represent the appellant, Michael Reichert. The big question in this case is whether this is the type of case that people in the future are really going to get to be able to take to a federal trial and to take it to trial, get damages, have their attorney's fees paid, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's a rare thing in this case where there is so much video evidence, at least it's rare in my experience, where there is so much evidence that's right there on video for everyone to see. And when you look at that video, let me back up.
Does the video show the plaintiff's car crossing the line?
No, it does not.
Okay, so we've got conflicting affidavits on that, right?
There is conflicting affidavits, but...
And without, if he didn't cross the line, there's no probable cause for the stop.
But there's only, correct, there's no probable cause because reasonable suspicion is what's necessary. And under the case law cited, the situation is that so long as the officer had reasonable suspicion, and it's almost a subjective test in his mind that a traffic violation was committed.
Either it was or it was not.
Excuse me?
Either it was or it was not. If the officer didn't see them cross a line,
correct,
there's no violation.
Correct.
Right?
That's right. And the officer alleges that they did cross the line.
And they testified that they did not.
Correct. Yes.
So
the cases cited submit that it takes more than just a counter statement from.
Let me ask you about that. And you're referring, I think, to page 4 of your reply brief, where you said the plaintiffs have provided sworn affidavits that Huff did not break his lane of travel prior to being stopped by Officer Reichert. Granted, affidavits may be used to defeat a summary judgment motion, but surely they must be corroborated with factual support in the record, right?
Correct.
Citing Albiero against City of Kankakee.
Correct.
I don't know if you noted that the Albiero case has been overruled on precisely this ground.
No, that I did not know.
In the case, did you check? The case was Hill against Tangerlini, 724 F3rd 965, which was one of many recent cases from this court that have tried to explain that when you have conflicting affidavits that are based on personal knowledge, you cannot resolve that issue on summary judgment.
Okay. I was not aware of that. And I must have missed it on the citation. I apologize. I guess my position on that still would be the Valance Weisel case, which was very similar. Affidavits being used, a complaint, deposition testimony, also countering the police officer's allegation as to driving out of his lane. And in that case, the court held that it took more than just
that
countering.
That was the fellow who wasn't sure through the S-turns, right?
Correct.
So, in essence, you had something versus nothing.
He wasn't sure in the beginning, but he was sure certainly shortly thereafter. And I think that's the case, too, when you see the video.
Why is there a problem with trying this case, given the conflicting evidence?
Because there's several counts on here, but it doesn't seem like it takes very much, at least in the qualified immunity.
It takes testimony that I didn't do anything wrong.
Correct.
Because the officer had no basis to stop, arrest, detain, and pat me down.
Well,
we've got here.
In that context, criminal case, what you suggest is kind of like a poisonous tree criminal case argument. And I don't think that applies in Section 1983 cases, although this circuit that I'm aware of has not applied that rule. But it seems to me there needs to be a gap, though, between in a criminal context, and there's a lot of motion to suppress cases cited because that's where this mostly comes up, where there isn't probable cause for a search or a pat down or a stop. And in all those cases, then, because that's when a constitutional right was violated. So in all of those cases, it's then going to be then, well, your constitutional right was violated because you didn't have probable cause in this criminal context. Therefore, you must have a Section 1983 case.
Qualified immunity provides a fair amount of latitude. But let me ask you if I could. about the pat-down. That came after the officer had decided simply to give the plaintiff a warning for this lane violation that might or might not have occurred, right?
Correct.
So at that point, what articulable facts supported a conclusion that either plaintiff was armed and dangerous and therefore subject to a pat-down under Terry?
I think it's difficult to say, at least by the record. But
sure is.
And my best explanation on why he wanted to pat him down was, well, I'm turning my back on you. I'm going to be walking the dog around here, and it's an issue of safety's sake.
So under this theory, a police officer can pat down anybody in a traffic stop?
I don't think that would be the
case.
That's
not the law.
No, I'm not saying that, and that's not the law.
So what else is there here?
Well, there was in this case where there was a marijuana cultivation charge from a few years ago.
From
there was also
10 or more years ago,
correct.
And no conviction, correct?
That's right. And also a battery charge.
Many years ago,
yes.
No conviction.
Correct, yes. And I would also contend, though, when you do watch the video, I would say that there's some consent with it, at least the pat-downs. When he was explaining the situation and he said, well,
can you imagine what would have happened if they had resisted the pat-down?
He wasn't asking
them for consent, was he?
He told them, he informed them, I'm going to pat you down,
yes.
I'm going to walk my dog, and before he finished his sentence, even though they were ready for the pat-down in both cases.
Isn't that a good thing?
Yes, I think so.
Even if their rights are being violated. We want them to bring suit rather than to fight the officer, right?
I think it certainly made it a congenial atmosphere, I guess, and an easier atmosphere for the pat-down. This is a stop that happens 50 states, Washington, D.C., perhaps 1,000 times a day. And a lot of these cases, people are let go with no citation, or if a citation, perhaps it's later dismissed or court supervision or something like that. It's a case where the plaintiffs, in my contention, is that they were not arrested. And so when you get into the probable cause.
What were they supposed to do if they weren't arrested? If they were theoretically free to leave.
Yes.
Could they have walked down the interstate?
No.
And the police were going to keep their car.
They had.
So how were they not detained?
They offered them a ride.
So you're not in custody because I, police officer, will take you someplace.
Correct. Wherever you want
to
go.
In the back seat of my car, which is locked and you can't get out of it.
Mm-hmm. It would have been the case.
How is this not an arrest?
Well, it is. It gives them the option, and I guess the context.
And
then
by the way, what were they arrested? What was probable cause for what?
Well, the probable cause. Well, the reasons for it were listed that his driver's license, the address did not match up,
but it was a valid document.
Turned out to be so. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Correct.
Anything else?
Prior marijuana charge, prior battery charges, not convictions.
If that gives you a basis for being arrested 10 years later, we're in a very different country than I
right.
imagine. What else?
Just a known stretch of highway known for drug and traffic.
So anybody who drives down that interstate is vulnerable to arrest and search without anything further?
No.
No, of course not.
They should not be. No.
And you don't have anything else?
For the arrest issue, if you're at that point, no. As far as the search of the car, then, there was also the dog sniff.
The district judge on that found that there was a disputed issue of fact.
Right.
I don't know whether I would have reached the same conclusion, but given that the district judge found a disputed issue of fact, we can't evaluate whether he was right or wrong about that on appeal, right? We have to take his fact-finding as given.
I agree. Yes.
So we've got a disputed issue of fact about whether you've got a good indication, a reliable indication by the dog.
Correct. And what I would indicate, though, is that it's an irrelevant fact, and that case would not come into play. What the lower court talked about was that he went into the training of the dog and the accuracy of the dog and that type of thing. And in this case, though, the complaint doesn't argue about the training and the accuracy of the dog. The dog is that they made the dog falsely alert.
The district judge found a disputed issue of material fact about the reliability of the alert. So if the alert wasn't reliable, as we must assume here, then What's the basis? I mean, you can go in trial and argue that that this was reliable, right?
They will. But what they're arguing, actually, I mean, what their complaint, though, is about, I think was what the judge was talking perhaps a little bit different. Their complaint is that he basically fraud, that I made that dog alert, in which case I would say, well, it doesn't matter if that dog is 100% reliable or zero reliable, well-trained or not trained. If I'm making my dog false alert, the dog's accuracy and training has nothing to do with it. I'm committing fraud there. And I think there needs to be some sort of evidence coming forth that there was actual committed fraud.
You haven't answered how we have jurisdiction to decide that issue.
Yes, and on that point, I am not disputing the lower court's facts on that. I would contend it's not a fact relevant to the legal analysis.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Meyer?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Lewis Meyer, and I represent the plaintiffs' appellees in this case, Terrence Huff and John Seaton. What this case is, it's an appeal of a denial of qualified immunity on a summary judgment. First off, as this Court has raised, is there an issue of jurisdiction, whether or not this Court can even hear this appeal, because the basis for the denial of qualified immunity were disputed facts. So it's not simply a legal conclusion. We have disputed facts which set forth those violations. Therefore, this appeal should not be heard. Not all qualified immunity denials are appealable. So I just want to address the four claims that plaintiffs make in succession. The first is the unreasonable seizure. It's plaintiffs' position that there was no traffic violation. They both submitted affidavits, they both testified, and even on the traffic video, Mr. Huff confronts the officer and says, I did not do it, you just said I did. So we have a disputed factor whether or not a traffic violation occurred. If none occurred, then Officer Riker had no probable cause to stop the plaintiffs and therefore violated their Fourth Amendment, which is not a trivial allegation. The cases cited by a defendant in their brief are very distinguishable and much different. The main case I rely on is the Vansel case, which you pointed out, he did not believe that he didn't commit the crime. He wasn't sure. He was wishy-washy. We don't have that here. There's affidavits saying, I didn't break my lane of travel. That's before he even met with me, the lawyer. On the scene, he says, I didn't do what you did. The disputed fact, so granting qualified immunity would be improper in that case. The next claim is the false arrest claim. As shown in the video, after Reichert conducted his investigation of this alleged traffic violation, concluded with a handshake and here's your warning, he detained the plaintiffs longer. In order to detain the plaintiffs longer, he would have to have developed something during this traffic stop that would give him reasonable suspicion to justify this longer detention. And so the defendants tried to cite that he did by his driver's license, which was valid, a temporary insurance card, a criminal arrest from more than 10 years ago that it didn't lead to convictions, alleged nervousness by his passenger, which is disputed and is not clear on the video, and finally the stretch of highway. Taking those even cumulatively did not rise to the level of reasonable suspicion to think that a crime is afoot to justify this prolonged detention. And additionally, Mr. Huff, when he's given the warning, asked Mr. Riker, am I free to go? Can I go? Showing that he wants to leave, and this is not a consensual police encounter where it's just talking or you can walk away. Mr. Huff tried to walk away. Officer Riker denied him that liability, saying, I'm keeping your car. And then tries to justify, saying, oh, you are free to go, but here are the caveats. I can't let you walk down the highway. It's illegal. I'll arrest you. Here's my armed officer. We can give you a ride to a gas station, but if I don't find anything in your car, I'm going to tow it, and it's going to be impounded. You have to go get it. If I do find something there, I'm going to come and arrest you. So he didn't really have a free choice. They had no choice but to stay on the side of that road. That converted this traffic stop under Terry into a full-blown arrest when they were not free to leave. Next is a search of the person. Once again, the only authorization to search someone during a traffic stop is you can point to some type of articulable suspicion that they may be armed or dangerous. They cannot do that here. Furthermore, the fact of when this pat-down or search occurred was so far into this traffic stop that if he was concerned, it would have been something he would have done right away when he took them out of the vehicle. So it casts doubt on any alleged fear that Officer Reichert may have. And counsel said it's an officer safety issue because he turned his back. It's clear from the video that Mr. Huff and Mr. Seaton were both right next to an armed police officer who was watching them while he went to conduct the search. They're not able to point to any type of reasonable suspicion that they are armed and dangerous. And once this consent issue, this is not valid consent. They're under duress. They've had these threats. They have nothing else to do. Instead of starting a longer argument with this officer, they basically just give up. So it wouldn't even be valid consent. And once again, it's a disputed fact, not appropriate for qualified immunity. Finally, the search of a vehicle. Here, we alleged in the complaint, and even though this was a summary judgment, if you look at the docket, that was the first motion filed by the defendants. They didn't even answer the complaint. We have not had a lot of discovery. We've been litigating multiple summary judgment motions without an answer. Luckily, we were able to depose plaintiffs and Officer Reichert. And what we've alleged is that this was an improper search. Whether he cued the dog is the one we believe he did, shown on the video. And we also believe that the dog, and we have submitted in the evidence, that there are some questions about this dog's training and reliability. We want to further go into those, that investigation in this case. But we have alleged facts that the search was improper, the dog was cued, and it was not a reliable alert. The district court determined that there was a disputed fact there. Once again, that is not proper in this venue for the denial of qualified immunity. It's a basic notice pleading. Defendants in the in the reply brief mentioned about we haven't had this expert. Well, we have four, but before we can submit a proper expert report, we need this additional discovery we're seeking about the dog's training, about additional arrest. So I think that's more of a red herring in the
Excuse me just a minute. This has absolutely nothing to do with the facts of the case. What does your client do for a living?
He's a documentary filmmaker.
What?
A documentary filmmaker. He's a filmmaker, editor, makes videos.
Is that for a certain amount of leisure time, I take it?
I think it does. Enough time to get down to St. Louis for a Star Trek convention on your birthday.
Yeah.
You know, this case and these allegations should be submitted to a trial. The fact that they argue that every traffic stop shouldn't turn into a civil rights violation, some may not, but the law allows us as citizens to do that. If your rights are violated, whether you're arrested and locked up for 20 years or if you're held on the side of a road on your birthday for 50 minutes.
There is a difference, but you're quite right.
There
is
no
difference. It's an academic thing.
Damages may be different, and I understand that, but it's still
besides the damages, there are a few other things.
A few other differences besides damages, you're correct. And we would respectfully submit that this court uphold the district courts and affirm the denial of qualified immunity summary judgment. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks, Meyer. Mr. Giancoletto, your time expired, but you may have 1 minute.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. On the issue of a stop like this turning into an arrest, then, if the situation were that this stop happened outside the gentleman's house, he would have been free to leave and presumably walked in his house, or if it's on Main Street, he walks down the Main Street and he leaves, and I think we wouldn't have this issue. The problem is then the officer is left with the situation, okay, I'm out on a highway, and so now I think that's a tough call that the officer has to make, a constitutional call that he has to make in the field that, okay, I'm out on the highway and I can't really do this anymore with this guy or hold him here while I move his car or move him, but if I'm in front of his house, I'm okay. I think that's
a
tough.
Is it your position because it's a swerve that the officers thought he had a possible drunk driver?
No, I can't say that that's in the record.
Right.
He just violated, in the officers, what he says, he violated state law by leaving his lane of traffic without a signal and moving back into it.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, well, thank you. Case is taken under advisement.